Well, the first radio was my father in his younger days was an electrician, and he was all excited about this new, they called it wireless, I think, then. He apparently had got a hold of some information on this, and he was going to build his own radio. My name is Margaret Kathleen Burns Nee McPhee. I'm 99. I will be 100 on the 24th of April. So he had a tube, I would say about a 2 or 3, maybe 3 inch tube. And he was wrapping copper wire around it so that it was fully covered, the tube. And I was just a very young girl, and I asked him what he was doing. So he told me that he was trying to get sound because he'd been hearing about this new thing. As I say, at that point they were calling it wireless.
Do you think it was like the early 30s?
I
know you're not sure, yeah.
I'm not sure. As I say, my sisters must have been high school age, you know. You can take about 10 years off mine. I don't know how you'd go back on that.
Yeah, it's probably like the late 20s, early 30s. That's what I'm guessing, yeah.
Yeah. And so he worked on it, and I sat there, of course, glued to the thing, and he said sound would come out of it. So he worked and he worked and I sat and I sat, and finally he got it all covered and did a few things which I didn't understand. And what he got was a lot of noise. It wasn't words he was getting, it was just lots of crackling noise. Well, I think perhaps it was the first do-it-yourself thing I ever saw done that didn't work out. So, of course, in due time, we did get a radio. It was a big piece of furniture. And my sisters, my older sisters, were having a party, which they did back in those days at home.
Do you think they told their friends, like, oh, we have a radio, and like, do you think people were kind of excited?
I think they were all looking forward to it. It was the big thing of the party. And so it came, and the party came, and Dad didn't know how to work it. So that was another do-it-yourself that kind of fell through.
That was the second radio he had then.
Yeah, and he had Eaton's come out the next morning to show him how to work it. But he was so angry. I can remember he was just so angry. But we enjoyed it. We used to all sit around and listen to the programs. And my dad in particular really did enjoy it very much. The radio is very important to keep up with the news daily. And if you have a radio handy, you can be listening and still go on with what you're doing.
My grandma's heard a lot of radio over the last century.
Donate to CITR 101.9 FM.
Keeping local independent radio alive doesn't have to be as hard as building your own radio. Support CITR's fund drive by donating at citr.ca/donate. Help keep CITR weird. Please, if you're able to, consider donating to CITR for our fund drive. We love making Seeking Office and our weekly radio show, Democracy Watch, but most of it's produced by volunteers. And in order to keep this kind of local independent news content coming, we really do need your support. So please consider donating monthly or giving a one-time donation. You can do so by going to citr.ca/donate. It's really easy. We really appreciate it. We really need your support to keep going. Thank you so much. TR's News Collective.
At large.
Is that too short?
No.
At large.
From CITR's News Collective. Lola, why don't you try it?
Sick. You're listening to At Large from the News Collective at CITR.
Councillor Herbick.
This is a real toughie because I have very big issues with this overarching policy, and echoing Councillor Fry's remarks, we're asking to go along with it. And it also begs the question on these rezoning applications, because they conform with policy, does that mean we have to automatically approve them? If so, why do we even go through the process? I have reservations about this, and it's not, it's a perfectly fine development and a good design, but there are serious issues, and we are trying to go into a citywide planning process, and we continue to approve and move forward on policies that, in my view, are not in keeping with the best interests of the city overall. So I'm really wrestling with this one, and I just wanted to go on the record as stating why I'm wrestling with it, because we're being asked to shoehorn it in, and I'm actually quite sympathetic to what Councillor Swanson has put forward.
The dilemma posed by Councillor Colleen Hardwick is in reference to a Rental 100 development at 1906 to 1918 West 4th Avenue, which council passed on Tuesday, February 26th. Initially, Councillor Jean Swanson added an amendment to this development, which imposed vacancy control on the units in the development, meaning rent would be tied to the unit rather than to the tenant, and this amendment passed in a 6-5 vote. However, a revote was called for shortly after, and the amendment was undone. Councillor Adrian Carr initially supported Councillor Swanson's motion to impose vacancy control on this development, but then called for a reconsideration of the vote and voted against the motion. In the end, the project passed without vacancy control. We called Councillor Carr to ask why her perspective on this project changed so drastically, and whether it's the job of councillors to approve projects that meet existing policy standards, even if they personally disapprove of those projects. Here's what she had to say.
But my name's Alex DeBoer, and I'm also joined in studio by my colleague Zoe Power, just so you know.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Hi, Zoe.
Hello. Lovely to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us. So we wanted to talk to you about a council meeting from this Tuesday. So on Tuesday of this week, Councillor Swanson put forward a motion to impose vacancy control on a development application for 1606 West 4th Avenue, and you initially seconded this motion, but after it passed, you called for a reconsideration of the vote. I was wondering if you could tell me first why you were initially in support of the motion.
Because in general, I believe in vacancy control. I think the city should have legal avenues to pursue vacancy control. We haven't done that yet, but in the absence of it, we are seeing real problems in terms of increasing rents. And in fact, we've heard from speakers who've come to us at council to say that they end up getting evicted for a variety of reasons, and they're extremely distraught about that, but then they also hear that once they're out of a place, the rents jack up, and so it's really leading to unaffordability escalating even higher in the city.
Okay, and then so after that initial vote, which was in favor by 6-5, Councilor Melissa DeGenova asked the city manager if there were any legal dangers to imposing this vacancy control motion on the development, and DeGenova was assured that the city had the full legal right to add that motion or to pass that motion. So given that the city wouldn't be vulnerable to legal action, why did you then call for a revote?
I called for a revote because of the issue of fairness. And in a sense, it's really an ethical issue. Because it's very hard for me to think about a developer, an applicant for a redevelopment or a development project, to go through all the rules, laws, bylaws, policies that are in place within the city, work with our staff, invest in the development of a project, and comply in the end with all of those rules, and then at the very end of the process have council say, oh, well, we actually don't like those rules. We think they should be different, and we're going to deny your application. So after seeing that the project would have been turned down and hearing two things from the city manager, one is, although we're within our legal right to do that, that in fact the decision would probably kill the project, I thought, is that fair? And I really ended up concluding it's not fair, but we as council should get on with changing the rules.
Right. I'm just curious. So when you say the decision, if Gene Swanson's motion had passed, that would have probably killed the project. In what way would the project have been killed? Like, would it have become unprofitable or what?
Correct.
Okay.
What we were informed is that obviously every project needs a pro forma. It has to look at the costs of developing versus the profitability of the project. And if there is a, you know, if there's a concern around profitability that is so steep that there, you know, doesn't look like there's going to be a reasonable expectation of the project having financial viability, then the project doesn't go forward. But if the rents are being charged as high as they are, and under our bylaws, which I am aiming to change with my own motion that's coming forward, I think our bylaws are terrible in terms of allowing the waiver of DCLs at such high prices for rent that are really unreachable for most people. But still, in all, those rents are ones that were included in the project, and it is, you know, it's hard for me to imagine that at those high rents, there still would need to be raising the desire to raise those rents. I kind of actually, in the end, I'm going to trust that those having such high rents as the starting rents or the able to be in place starting rents won't necessitate the need to actually raise them after people leave and there's turnover. But anyway, that aside, it really is the fact that if I'm hearing that it's not going to work financially, I didn't want to see that particular project killed.
Yeah, a follow-up question about, I guess, the relationship between those rents and this policy. Given that you are pretty understandably, I think, reluctant to punish developers who've fulfilled all of the existing requirements, do you see Rental 100 as a viable vehicle for implementing vacancy control or affordability measures of any kind in Vancouver?
Well, we have to change the structure of Rental 100 radically. In other words, the effectiveness of the program in delivering real affordability. I don't think it's delivered real affordability, but I want the data back from our staff to verify that. And then I want to see a wholesale change. It may not even be called Rental 100. It may not even be on the same kind of structure. Perhaps DCL waivers are one thing we can continue to use, but under different circumstances. I want our staff to go out and give a solid research report back on what other methods we can use to achieve real affordability. There may have to be incentives. I want to know what those incentives are that are not going to cost an arm and a leg on the part of the city and actually be effective, but more than anything else, achieve the kind of affordable rents that are tagged to people's income at 30% of gross income, as all the standard definitions, CMHC, BC Housing are. And so we should be in line with those and then get on with providing those particular incentives that work for the developer, but moreover, work to deliver affordability.
Right, right. And so you put forward a motion to review Rental 100 and other housing policies, which passed. So staff are going to look into that. But included in revisions of Rental 100 or other housing policies, would there be something that gets City Council to request the provincial government to implement vacancy control, since they ultimately have that power?
Yeah. You know, I think we're on record. I believe that was part of a motion that came up earlier, maybe through Councillor Swanson.
But that was struck out.
Oh, it was struck out. Well, yeah. I'd be supportive of pursuing that, actually. In the last terms I've been on council, I've also expressed my opinion that I think vacancy control is a good policy that that can help renters. It obviates the need for renters to be evicted just so that a landlord can bring in another renter and obviously start a lease with a much higher rent price. I don't think that that happens across the board. I think there are very good landlords in this city, ethical and landlords who really want to provide affordable, long-term, secure housing for people. I certainly know many people who have been in place where their rents have remained low over many, many years.
Right.
And so we want to obviously continue to laud those people, but we want to rein in those who are abusing that.
Yeah. Right, right, right. So just to get back to the sort of central sort of issue of this interview. So it's interesting because you're saying that you're in favor of vacancy control, but you also value fairness. And that's why you, in the end, didn't support Gene Swanson's motion. So I'm just wondering, it was interesting because Councillor Hardwick asked sort of what role an elected council has if councillors are obligated to sort of mechanically approve projects which meet existing policy obligations. I'm just wondering, is the answer to that question sort of nuanced, like based on whether a council is new and whether they're dealing with policies from the previous council, or do you have an answer to that, or are you still wondering sort of the same thing?
That's a really good question. I think the obligation of a council, if it consistently sees that there are problems with a particular policy and the application of it that they're uncomfortable with, it's the duty of that council to make changes. And that's what I think we're hearing from councillors with this new council around the unaffordability of housing that's produced in our city, and in particular housing that's produced through incentive programs that waive DCLs and take away the money that should be going into the city coffers for DCLs, and thus the development of public benefits. And that's why I said at the time of that hearing, but also at other times recently, look, I have a motion on the docket. We're going to be looking at it. It is to reexamine every aspect of the way our bylaws, our rules, regulations, policies establish affordability so that we can actually aim for the real affordability, as I say, pegged to household income, not pegged to the market, and change those policies. And we need to do it fast because it's very uncomfortable to feel at odds with the legislation we do have in place or the rules and regulations we have in place and have to balance or trade off the desire to vote for something that you may not like but that has followed the rules, but
right.
You don't like it because you don't like the rules.
Right. It makes sense in the case of like where council's at right now, about to pass a citywide plan, about to perhaps be revising Rental 100 and other policies, that councillors would be able to kind of vote to pass developments that they know in the future they'll be able to apply more affordability standards to. But just, I'm sort of wondering kind of more philosophically or whatever, do you think councillors should vote kind of their conscience, even if a housing development, whatever it is following the rules, if they disagree with that?
That's a really, really good question. And it's one that I have thought a lot about, because in my last two terms on council, I felt very free to vote always in line with my conscience, my desires for what I want to see in the rules and regulations and policies of the city, and to make note of that. But I was in a major minority. There was one green, and there was a majority of vision counselors. And I, you know, in the end, truly, almost all, I can't even think of a development project that didn't go ahead under vision. So I was able to make those points and speak, you know, the truth of my conscience around around how I felt the projects were unaffordable and didn't really comply with what I believed to be measures that are sorely needed to get at affordability within our city. Now it's quite a different situation. And, you know, at the time, too, I thought, you know, I understand this developer has gone through all those rules and complied with them. And so I don't fault them for complying with the rules. Just the rules suck. But I had no control over changing those rules, because every time I tried to change them, I was blocked by vision. But now is a different situation. Mm-hmm. Now we are in a position where we are in a much more collaborative council. It is a council truly of equals. You know, there's virtually no partisanship or sort of dogged alliances. It's a situation where we can change those rules. So I just feel that that's where we need to put the focus, is saying, okay, these may not be the kinds of project due to lack of affordability that we want to see. Well, let's get on with changing the rules then, so that developers know the new rules under which they have to apply, and those rules will deliver the affordability that we and the people want.
Okay. Are you good, Zoe?
I'd like to just ask one follow-up question about something you said earlier in the interview, if that's okay. You expressed your sort of hope that approving what you describe as like already quite high beginning rentals on these new developments would reduce the need for landlords to then increase rents further, like later in the life of these new build projects. I'm wondering like what you think it says about the prospects for implementing true affordability measures, that a project like the one that was debated and then ultimately approved on Tuesday would and has been deemed economically unviable without the right to increase rents at will in between future tenancies down the line?
Yeah, you know what? That is a really good question. And I must admit, I did ponder that. At this point, I'm trusting the information that I am receiving from our senior staff. But the question did cross my mind as to, you know, really, these rents are already so high. And is there an expectation that they will be higher in the future, and the project is sort of including that? So it's something that I flagged in my own head for follow-up. And I really want to question the pro formas in terms of starting rents versus expected future rents. And see if there are if those kinds of issues are addressed when our staff run through the pro formas with the applicants for development approval.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time, Councillor Carr.
No, I appreciate the questions.
Thank you for listening.
Have an excellent weekend.
This story was reported by Alex DeBoer and Zoe Power. Special thanks to the News Collective at CITR.